This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon, this is Live and Learn and I'm Chua Eun Teck. The bombing of a night spot in Puchong last month marks a watershed in Daesh's influence in Malaysia. It is their first successful attack in the country and they've followed it with promises of more to come. On the show today to explain how we can respond to the terrorist group's threat is Dr. Masli Malik, Assistant Professor at the International Islamic University. Dr. Masli researches the intersection of politics and religion and recently wrote about his findings working with Daesh-linked detainees in Malaysia. Let's start with the bombing in Puchong last month. It was the first ever IS attack in Malaysia. What were your initial reactions?
I thought the other day they've decided to change IS to Daesh, the Arabic term for it. And thanks French government for initiating. It became the first country to initiate that. But anyway, yeah. IS, ISIS,
ISIS. Yeah, it went from ISIS whatever. To yeah, ISIL. Yeah, yeah. And then, so Daesh is the international recognized
term. Yeah, because to avoid any misunderstanding of the word IS of Islamic State. So what about it? Okay. Referring to the Puchong incident, I mean, the very first reaction I was having when listening to the news, I said, God, they are here. They've started. And it's only the beginning. So, yeah, that was my reaction.
They've always been here, isn't it, based on news reports. All it takes is just 2% in this particular instant.
Yeah, I mean, if you look at the current escalation, the latest escalation of Daesh, ISIS, whatever you call them, it's not rather surprising. I mean, since April or since early this year, they've been issuing. I mean, if you look at their social networks, or their pages, their news channels, whatever, they're having approximately 6,000 memes within this social media network from Twitter account, Facebook, you know, those kind of YouTube channels. And they have started giving instruction to what I mean by them is the central IS back in Iraq and Syria where they are operating now. They have started issuing or giving instructions to their sympathizers and anybody who sympathizes with their cause to launch lone wolf attacks. And if you look at the recent video that been issued by IS branch in southern Philippines, which now they've been recognized by the central IS as the new territory, or what they call it in Arabic as wilaya, one of IS territories outside of the central IS. You have similar wilaya or territory in Sinai, in Libya, in some other parts of the world, and they considered that this is part of them. So they're giving clear instruction that you have the autonomy, launch your attacks, and those representatives of IS from, if not mistaken, in that video that been viral on YouTube and Facebook, part of their propaganda for Southeast Asian IS sympathizers and recruits. They have three people from three different countries, from Indonesia, from Malaysia and the Philippines, talking with their own language, giving instruction to all Muslims to join them. If they couldn't perform a migration to Syria, migrate to southern Philippines. If they couldn't do that, what they clearly say, do it on your own soil. Attack the police officers or, you know, what they call also the infidels. If you have car, ram them. If you have knives, stab their hearts. You know, those kind of things. A clear instruction of instigating lone wolf to initiate attacks. So it appears only, I'm not mistaken, few days, less than a week before the Movida incident in Puchong. Yeah. So when it happened, I said, it's the only beginning. And it's more intricate because if it is an organized, planned attack, I think it's easier for the special branch to detect, to clamp down, whatever. But when it is initiated by individuals, isolated individuals, self-radicalized, I think the situation becoming more intricate.
Isn't it also worrying that two police officers from Kedah police were involved?
I'm not sure whether they are directly involved in the attacks. What we have heard from the security forces' statements that on the round, the tension of those who suspected involved in the attacks were that two policemen that I couldn't give any comment. I think you should ask the IGP instead.
The IGP has since cautioned the public that there will be more IS threat. How do you think we should be responding since their social media messaging is so prolific?
Don't be afraid. There are only a small group of culprits. And we, the mass majority, we should stand together. And first and foremost, we should ask why these individuals are driven so easily to launch lone wolf attacks. Why they have been pushed to do such thing? I would say that some of them, they might have some psychological issues. Yeah, we have few incidents involving those with mental sickness or whatever. And some of them, out of simplistic thinking, and they are in searching for, you know, things or means that would boost their confidence or proving that they are hero. You know, there is a term in psychology, the grandeur delusion or delusion of grandeurism. People looking at themselves, they are hero. They're trying to prove that they are hero. So I think some of those sympathizers, at least some of those I've encountered while doing the rehab program in Sungai Buloh prison, they have this kind of feeling that they want to be helpful, they want to be meaningful, and they want to be useful for the cause of Muslims. So they started thinking that they need to do something. So IS, unfortunately, providing them with that false solution. You want to be useful, you must perform jihad, quote-unquote jihad. How that jihad would be, blow yourself, kill the infidels, you know, do attacks, do bombings, and then you would find IS media will be glorifying you, said, we have this fighter in Malaysia, in Nice, France, in Germany, they are doing this and they're going to have, you know, this kind of narrative. So how should we react? You should come up with counter-narratives. We should come up with counter-propaganda. You look with the 6,000 means that they have in the social media networks, how much do we provide to counter them? I'm not sure in Malaysia how much do we have, but let alone our mainstream media, how do we provide the counter-narrative instead of the narratives of hatred, narrative of, you know, hopelessness, helplessness and, you know, frustration? Why don't we give hope? Why don't we give them a more meaningful solution? I mean, this youth, put aside all those with mental and psychological problem, but these youth who feel frustrated of what's happening all around the world, they feel that there is a global injustice happening to their Muslim brethren all around the world, where they've been perpetrated by what they call as the imperialists, the big Satan, or it is being perpetrated by Muslim regimes themselves. So they feel that diplomacy is not working, democracy is not working, no peaceful means is working. So the only thing that they would resort to, and they thought that is the way to solve the problem, is by picking up guns and initiating violence. So we move forward.
Just to stay on this, you mentioned that in your research, you interviewed 30 detainees who were arrested under SOSMA at the prison in Sungai Buloh. What were your impressions from that encounter?
Now, I think the number has changed. It's no longer 30, it's 35. And they are there not for a permanent stay while waiting for the trial. You know, SOSMA, there are trials they will send before the court to defend themselves, etc. Out of the whole 30 prisons, I think now it's only 10 left. The 25 have pled guilty. They've been sent to I'm not mistaken, to Tapah prison. So from these 35 detainees, when I encountered them, you know, just like any normal Malaysian citizens, we have our preconceived idea, preconceived feeling towards them. But after a year of the rehab program, I started to pity them. Not pity them because they're terrorists, no. But pity because some of them, I would say that they are prey and victims. Out of their ignorance, out of their simplistic thinking, which been caused by, I'm very lack to say this, but our educational system that do not teach people to think critically and to appreciate life, beauty, and we're lacking of the idea of mutual respect, you know. And they are the victims of the situation, I would say. Yes, few of them, they are very ideologically driven. But what I found from most of them, those young people below 25, they're just simple person with a very utmost simplistic thinking. And their judgment is very, you know, kind of reaction kind of judgment, which is due to whatever situation they've gone through, or due to sometimes they've been lured or they've been deceived with certain narrations that have been fed into their mind. Hopefully, they will change their mind and their heart after this detention.
My guest today is Dr. Masli Malik, Assistant Professor at the International Islamic University. We'll talk more about the threat of Daesh in Malaysia after the break. BFM 89.9. Good afternoon. This is Live and Learn. I'm Chua Untik. Today, we're talking about the threat of Daesh in Malaysia with Dr. Masli Malik at the International Islamic University. Before the break, Dr. Masli was speaking about his experience working with Daesh-linked detainees at the Sungai Buloh prison. What was their first encountered, or how did they encounter the propaganda that is Daesh or ISIS?
Oh, different individuals have different, let me say, motivations and different situations. Some of them, you know, you would be surprised that some of those have been not interviewed actually, I was doing rehab to them and counselling sessions. Some of them, they were not having any religious background. They were not the mosque-going youth. They're not kind of, you know, what you see people wearing jubah, wearing robe, or wearing that skull cap. No. Some of them, they were club-goers. Some of them, they're taking ganja, for example. And some of them, just normal, simple person. But what triggered them? This is very important. What I found, that what unite them together in this ISIS or Daesh sympathy was the feeling of the need to do something to help those Syrians that been brutally killed by Bashar al-Assad's regime. That's number one. And number two, the feeling of the responsibility not only to help the victims, but to eliminate the cause that have been put all this, not only the Syrians, but the Iraqis, into the terrible situation they're living with, that they're living in, sorry. So for them, they are there as the Avengers superhero to help them. They feel that their responsibility, and furthermore, in their course, if they die, they go straight away to heaven. With all the baggages, the scenes that that they've been carrying all this while, so that's a shortcut to heaven. That the shortest way to heaven by sacrificing yourself in order to fight for a bigger cause. That's what they think. Very simplistic thinking.
They're not just folks from the kampung. These are city dwellers as well. They have educational attainment. They're from the middle income background.
It is very interesting. Despite of the various walks of life they're coming from, different backgrounds they're coming from. But I did notice one thing, at least with those 35 detainees that I've encountered, most of them, they have not gone through tertiary education, at least out for these 35 detainees. Unlike the previous groups that we have encountered before, the KMMJI, you know, you have those professors from university, you have professionals. No, unlike them, IS is a very, I would say, mass appealing organization, because all those youth that have met, I would say that 90% of them without tertiary education. And I would say 80% of them, they have no permanent job. Not I'm saying they're jobless, but I'm not saying, but what I'm trying to say is they don't have any, you know, good permanent job like what you're having now and others. Some of them, they're only selling nasi lemak. And I still remember, I said, how do you get your nasi lemak sold? Because you managed to raise how many hundred within a week by selling nasi lemak. I said, because I'm selling nasi lemak ISIS. I put the banner there, Nasi Lemak IC, so everybody or feeling that sympathy towards the cause of Syrian people or whatever, say, that's frightening. But, and some of them, they were selling, what they call it, selling beverages, jualai, you know, in front of schools, you know, this kind of, and some of them, they work with, they work at shops, they work at factories, you know, those kind of works. With the exception of five army personnel. But the rest, simple people, you know, like what we normally say, people on the street, you know, they're not that sophisticated. Yeah.
So being an ISIS sympathizer, they are not a minority here? They are not frowned upon here? If that person is able to openly brand his Nasi Lemak or IA as an ISIS IA.
Yeah.
But isn't that shocking?
I think that happened 2 years ago where people were not very clear what ISIS is all about. And I should remember Pew Research conducted perceptions of Malaysians towards ISIS, at least amongst Muslims. They found that, well, a high acceptance of ISIS, but that was 2 years ago when people were not having any clear picture or any clue about what ISIS is all about. Because what they can see on the media is Syrian people being brutally slaughtered by their evil president Bashar al-Assad and, you know, those kind of things. So they thought ISIS was the messiah. And that was the case of those youth. They thought that ISIS was the messiah to save Syrian people. And not only to save Syrian people, but to liberate Muslim occupied countries like Palestine, you know. Mm-hmm. And you know, one thing about ISIS, they came with a package of solution. It's not only they are there to help the Syrians, but they say, we are there to liberate Muslim countries, including Palestine. Not only that, we are an Islamic state. Not only that, we have Hudud and we have Khalifa. We have all those packages. And it's very appealing to those poor souls that still in the searching of truth, in the searching of, you know, thing that would make themselves meaningful, useful for the Muslim nation. So it's very appealing. And it's very unfortunate, the reality, you know, the cruel reality that we're living with. We have no good example of any Muslim leaders or Muslim countries that are there to champion the plight of Muslims, deprived people, whether in terms of human rights, whether in terms of their, you know, their humanity or whatever. What we have and what we have been, what we can see on the media is, you know, brutal regimes here and there, coup d'etat here and there, you know, dictators ruling Muslim countries. And, you know, when ISIS came, they said, we are better than them. So we're not having a better solution. They are, but the narrative is not really popular in compared to ISIS. So that is why the sympathy of those people, why they buy ISIS and the Nasi Lemak, they've been sold by this guy, because they thought, I mean, 2 years or 3 years ago, 2 years ago, to be precise, that this is the solution for them. But gladly, eventually, people started to realize that, oh, they are not the messiah. They are the evil messiah instead. Yeah.
So I can understand that this, the need to seek higher fulfillment and also to help out your brethren, mm-hmm. Ideological or religious brothers and sisters. But what is the incentive then for them to launch an attack in a Muslim-majority country like Malaysia, like Indonesia?
Yeah, precisely. You know, one thing about the level of thinking, they say that they are there to help their Muslim brethren, and their Muslim brethren have been betrayed, no, have been slaughtered by, you know, those evil regimes, and they've been betrayed by Muslim regimes all over the world. That's number one. And number two, they said, because they're not doing anything to help, they are condoning whatever they're doing. That's number two. And number three, I mean, it goes furthermore. To the next layer, they're saying that, oh, they are all the same. Why? Because they're not ruling the country by using Islamic law. They're not implementing Islamic law. So whoever ruling Muslim majority country and not implementing Islamic law Hence, they are kafir. They're infidels. And they use the precise word for that. They call it taghut. Taghut means the transgressor. They are transgressor. They are the pharaoh. So because they are there as pharaoh and transgressor, in order to bring the true meaning of Islam, in order to bring back the glory of Islam, we must eliminate these pharaohs, these transgressors, and these infidels. We must replace them with, you know, with more Islamic one. That's the number four. And number five, is it? But that is too much. We cannot do that. But what we can do is we strike fear in their hearts by creating chaos here and there, bombings, attacks, shooting, whatever you can do, as a manifestation of your support for the bigger cause of the Islamic State, and a manifestation of your rejection of those transgressors. And according to the latest statement by IS, they said that is your jihad in your own soil to go to heaven. That's what motivated them. But it's crazy. Don't you think it's crazy? Doesn't make any sense. It's very un-Islamic. That's what they fail to see. They fail to see what beyond the horizon. They fail to see the bigger picture of Islam. You know, they miss the message of peace, the message of love, the message of, you know, helping the poor. And they miss the most important part in Islam, which is the consequentialism. You want to do something, make sure the consequences of things that you do will never bring harmful, not only to yourself, but also to others. And they miss the very important point that I'm sure not only in Islam, but all other religion is to bring happiness. You cannot bring happiness by bombings. You cannot bring happiness by shooting and by creating all this chaos globally. Yeah.
Are they receptive to that message when in your encounters with them, when speaking
not
to them?
On the first date. Rejection. Second date, rejection. Third date, but continuously convincing them and try to bring them to look at the blind spots that they never had opportunity. And one important thing is, you know, it's only one, two, three of them were coming from religious education, proper religious education, from madrasa, from school agama. The rest, they have no, I wouldn't say no, they are lacking of basic Islamic education. And that was amongst the misconceptions. Sometimes people like to point out, oh, the extremists or the terrorists, they are the products of madrasa, school agama. That's not true at all. If they are the products of madrasa, if they are products of school agama, they would end up being Islamic preacher like Ustad Kazim, Ustad Don, and, you know, Dr. Mazhar. But because they're not coming from religious education, so they will pick up anything that they could listen, they could see on the social media. There's a jihad, let's go. Instead of trying to find out there's a jihad, so what's Quran say about this? What's the scholar's interpretation about this? And is there any discipline dealing with it? No, they're not looking at that. For them, there's a jihad, and there's a group doing that, let's go. So I think this is amongst the misconception that we should correct. I mean, people thought, oh, school agama, madrasa, students are more prone to join. No, it's not. That's not the situation.
So along with popular misconception or perceptions of terrorists, the definition of terrorism is also widening, right? Because of more lone wolf attacks. There's this article in the New York Times which starts with the question, how do you identify who is a terrorist and who is just someone with a mentally unsound mind? I was curious, when you were interacting with the detainees, are they labelled as terrorists when they are arrested under SOSMA or PORTA? Are they labelled as terrorists?
It's very interesting. The word terrorist is very based on who define it. But I still remember when I was with Sydney Jones from Jakarta. I mean, she's one of the terrorism experts in the region. So she used the word fighters. And I corrected her. I told her, I haven't met any fighters amongst those detainees. Because for me, they haven't gone there yet. They haven't picked up arms yet. And the way I look at them, by no means they are fighters. You can only call them fighters if they are there. You can only call them fighters if they already resort to violence, or they if they're not engaging it directly, or they are indirectly involving with terrorism activities. But for at least those whom I encountered with, they're not yet there. They're only at the ideological level or sympathy level. They just only attended they attended sessions or indoctrination cells, whatever, but they're not there yet. But I couldn't guarantee once they step their feet on the Syrian soil, once they pick up arms, then only we can call them terrorists or fighters. But this is a case of at least whom I met there. The situation might be different with those who are already in southern Philippines, or at least those who are already engaged in planning the attacks, bombing, or engaging with the propagating, the propaganda, or spreading the ideas of ISIS, spreading the ideas of they need to do jihad in Malaysian soil. For me, they are terrorists. But again, when you say, what about those who are having certain mental issues or psychological situation, I think we need to get involved psychologists, psychiatrists in this effort. So that is why I keep mentioning everywhere that when we talk about terrorism, it's not only the concern of the security force and the government per se. It's an issue of the clash of civilizations, the clash of ideas, the clash between civilized society from different backgrounds, from various faiths and whatever, against those who are promoting the barbaric, not civilization, lifestyle. Those who denounce peace, those who subscribe to violence. So for me, we should stand together. I mean, we should get all those psychologists to get involved, academics, people on media like yourself at BFM and other radios, artists, comedians, athletes and religious authorities. I mean, instead of chasing around,
just with law enforcement.
Yeah. I mean, they should come up with counter narratives and counter propaganda, because we are not only facing groups nowadays, it's ideas. We are facing another counter civilization that started to emerge. So for that, we should stand together. And I would say that the religious authorities are not doing enough. Yeah, they should do more.
Aside from the religious authority, do you find yourself having support, interdisciplinary support from the psychologists, from the academics in your work at the prison, for example?
Yes. Currently, I'm trying to get the permission from the prison authority to do some research with all the detainees, not only in Sungai Buloh, but in other places, along with my friend, Professor Dr. Muhammad Atta Sharum from CUCMS, where we are trying to look from different angles. I brought him in and I brought somebody from economics to look at this, socioeconomic issues, socioeconomic angle. I'm in politics and religion, and we also try to get somebody from the sociology to look into issues that we might have overlooked. So this cross-disciplinary effort is there, but until now, we're still trying to get grant to do this. I hope anybody who listened to this, the authority, would try to approach me to provide us with some grants for this research to embark, and also the prison authority to give us permission to do this research.
Yeah, Dr. Masli Malik can be reached at the International Islamic University.
Or through ideas, maybe.
Through ideas as well. I guess furthering this siege mentality that the detainees have that you mentioned is the fact that there is this perception of a double standards among Western media, maybe even some media here, that more weightage is given to coverage when an attack happened in the West, like in Paris or Brussels or Nice,
rather than Istanbul or Dhaka
or even Baghdad,
Puchong.
Or Puchong. What do you make of that? Is that a false dichotomy?
Indeed, it is. You know, I'm not sure why the double standard there, because the double standard itself will enhance the discourse of the terrorists. They say, look, they're always practicing double standard even in their reporting. What more when they're dealing, you know, the double standard always being mentioned by them towards the so-called Western democratic proponents or countries. They say they want democracy and etc. But when an army coup d'etat happened in Egypt, they're supporting the regime. They're always there to support all those evil regimes who suit their interests or who serve their interests. So for these people, said, look here, we're living in a very unjust world. The only thing to solve this is by resorting to arms. Yeah. And you know, it's very pitiful to see also like sometimes the Islamophobia tendency encourage more the discourse of the IS. I mean, you have more people like Trump. You have more people going around orchestrating the hatred towards Islam and Muslim. It further enhanced these people to say that, look, we are really facing the infidels.
In the end, how concerned are you about recent developments here? And you mentioned Trump and around the world as well. Because I think the trend is also in Europe, where there is a inward-looking trajectory, turning away from the values of globalization. There are more distrust now. People are more suspicious. Is this foreboding of the near future?
No. Don't be afraid. We have to move forward. We have to unite. I mean, people who believe in peace, in harmony, in coexistence, should unite. We should unite and stand in a force to provide, you know, a clear alternative, clear solutions, and give hope to people that peace will always work, violence will reach its end. Yes, I couldn't deny that we have the fear somehow. We just couldn't expect it would happen anywhere. But again, we should put our trust on the power of love. We should spread the word of love. We should spread the word of mutual respect, mutual trust to each other. And we should begin in our country by saying no to racism, no to hatred, and no to extremism by all means, parties. We should stand together, provide a better narrative, better solution for coexistence and mutual respect.
Thank you, Dr. Masli.
You're welcome.
I've been speaking to Dr. Masli Malik, Assistant Professor at the International Islamic University, also a Senior Fellow at the Institute for Democracy and Economic Affairs, better known as IDEAS. You've been listening to Live and Learn on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, The Business Station.